This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, the renowned tech journalist, Kara Swisher, with her new memoir called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. It's kind of a love-hate story, really, I might describe it as, about the companies and devices we all use constantly but are alienated from at the same time, the tech moguls she has covered for 30 years who have powered these epic changes in our culture, and Kara's own changing views on the industry she's covered since the birth of the internet. Kara Swisher hosts the podcast On with Kara Swisher and co-hosts the podcast Pivot with her and Scott Galloway. She appears regularly on CNN, was a New York Times columnist, as many of you know, and founder of Recode, among other things. Kara, thanks for making this one of your stops. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. And most of my family is thrilled I'm here because they listen to you all the time.
Oh, that's great. Can I start with a story that some of our listeners may have seen in the New York Magazine excerpt from the book, in which you describe being a young journalist at the Washington Post like 30 years ago and being relegated to covering this new thing called the internet because the editors saw it as fringy, a low impact beat. What year was that? And why were you more interested than your editors at the time?
It was 92 or 93. I'm trying to, I covered AOL because they actually had me do it because I was the young person on the staff. I was young, relatively young compared to everybody else. I think it was in my early 30s. And I understood this internet computer thing. That was why I was put on it. I actually, you know, they had interest in me moving into political area, but I liked business. I like covering business. And I, you know, as you know, at the Washington Post, politics is the center of all the action there for your, if you're an ambitious young reporter. But I was super interested in digital right from the get-go. And it wasn't, I didn't think it was a backwater. I thought they were going to change everything. And so there was a company in the Washington area called America Online. And I that's the first company I covered. You know, at the time, computers were mostly around government contractors.
And yeah, we thought AOL was going to change the world at that time.
They
and
did.
Now we make fun of anyone who still has an AOL email address.
Yeah, but they did change the world. They introduced the vast majority of people, consumers, to the idea of using digital services. And they were the very first ones who commercialized it. They used to have a foam finger they used to give out that said, it's so easy to use, no wonder it's number one. And it was so easy to use. And that was a critical part of getting people to start to use the early internet. And now, of course, it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous in your life.
And that excerpt in New York Magazine includes a prediction you made early on, talk about changing the world, that apparently the Washington Post management didn't see coming and was skeptical of when you brought it up, that Craigslist would kill classified advertising in their newspaper and really all newspapers, just as a point of oral history. Can you tell some of that story?
Yeah, I think I had covered retail before I covered digital stuff at the Post. And I had seen how Walmart had come in, and there was a decimation of local retailers at the time. And there was things like Hechinger's and Woody's and things like that. And that really knocked a strut out of the economic underpinnings of the Washington Post, especially since Walmart, which was heavily technologically fast forward in terms of how to stock its stores. They didn't advertise because they didn't need to. They knew other ways of reaching customers. And that was a problem. And then I saw Craigslist, which was this digital classifieds, essentially. And it was at no cost to people, and it worked, and it was kind of fun. And if you remember classifieds from the old days, they were expensive. You had to deal with a difficult customer service representative much of the time. And most of all, they didn't work that well. They didn't work. You had to sit there and with your finger and go down the list. So a digital one, which is easily searchable and constantly updated with something and zero cost, was a much better thing. And when I saw it, I was particularly disturbed. I was like, this is a big business for the Washington Post. Same thing with news. When news became free online, even if you had to have differentiated news because you couldn't do things as usual. So all their economic, you know, all if you're thinking about like a stool, all three businesses were under siege by digital.
Yeah, and that was the tip of the iceberg, of course,
sure,
or maybe from Silicon Valley's perspective, the tip of the spear that has landed us in the place we're in now, where the old business models for journalism are disintegrating.
Done.
So much to the detriment of local news and maybe democracy itself.
Yeah,
as verified, truthful information that now has to compete with rampant disinformation on social media and all of that. And you point to this quote, and we're going to play the clip, from Mark Zuckerberg from 2021 on Facebook's responsibility for fighting that. This was on a podcast from The Verge, and here's that audio.
When you think about the integrity of a system like this, it's a little bit like fighting crime in a city. You know, no one expects that you're ever going to fully solve crime in a city. You know, the police department's goal is not to make it so that if there's any crime that happens that, you know, you say that the police department is failing. That's not reasonable. You know, I think instead, you know, what we generally expect is that, you know, the integrity systems, the police departments, if you will do a good job of helping to deter and catch the bad things when it happens and keep it at a minimum and keep driving the trend in a positive direction and be in front of other issues too. So we're going to do that here.
Mark Zuckerberg there, Kara Swisher here. Why'd you include that quote?
Because it was ridiculous. He doesn't, you know, he's actually being disingenuous there because he doesn't want to solve crime at all. He doesn't care if crime exists. He doesn't want to have a police department. And so a lot of these companies are media companies. They are media companies. And what the problem is media companies thought they were helpers of media companies when in fact they became media companies, except that they didn't take the responsibility parts very seriously, if at all, which means that they had all the benefits of media without any of the costs of media. So that was, you know, it's just such nonsense because essentially he owns the city, but he doesn't pick up garbage. He doesn't have street signs. You can't fire him. You can't get rid of him. You can't sue him. You can't throw the bum out. But he runs everything, and then meanwhile, he's decimated any other possibility of any businesses that would help a consumer in any way. So,
and that was shortly after January 6th. That was the context for that clip, talking about fighting disinformation. So what, if anything, are they doing differently now to fight disinformation in this year's presidential election cycle?
I don't think they're doing anything. I think they've cut back on content. They just have given up on it because it is massive. Look, in a recent interview, Elon Musk with Don Lemon talked about like, okay, there's 100 or 20 articles in a newspaper and there's 5 million. Well, that's not our problem. Just because you want to build a business where you have 5 million things to deal with a day and in X's cases, they don't make money. But you know, in Facebook's cases, just because you build a business with that much scale, it's not our problem. You can't monitor it. But that's how they like to say there's just too much of it. Well, don't build a platform like that. And so what they're doing is cutting back because it is really hard to monitor and it's very expensive. And their businesses soon become not such good businesses if they had to really do the kind of monitoring that's required. And so they hide behind the First Amendment and free speech in order to abrogate their responsibility to keep it clean. And they won't do it until they're forced to.
Listeners, anything you always wanted to ask Kara Swisher but never had her over for dinner, or maybe more aptly in this case, never engaged her on Twitter, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, on the occasion of the release of her new book, Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. By the way, do you tweet? Do you still tweet? A lot of people
Not really.
Have walked away from it.
No, I'm still there. I just am not giving up my name because some troll will take over it. And honestly, I've been there since 2007. I got there before he did. So I'm going to just stay, keep my little home. I don't because I've had to turn off comments. And I'd love to say this to everyone on Twitter who gives me a hard time. I don't like being called names all day. I just don't. I didn't happen before Elon took over and I got a little bit of it. Now, whenever I turn on comments, I get incredibly sexist and misogynistic things at me. And I'm sorry, I don't want to engage it. I don't have to. I don't have to have it happen to me on the street. I can walk away. And so I'm there, but I don't, I every now and then I put something up if I think it's important. But in general, no, I don't use it for much of anything. I just, except unless there's something related specifically to X and they do something, or if he puts up a particularly anti-trans or anti-gay thing or anti-women or anti, you know, anti-Semitic, if he promotes something like that. But that's just another Tuesday for him.
Is Elon Musk, who you've covered for so long and, you know, have had a real talking relationship with for decades, in a way, the personification of the extremes of tech's impact on society? Let me read a little bit of what you write for our listeners or describe it. You write that you admired the way that Musk moved toward big ideas that solve big problems, electric cars, solar panels, but now you call him one of the most carelessly dangerous men in the history of technology, and he didn't even know it. And you know, Kara,
that's Mark Zuckerberg.
I'm sorry, I got that mixed up. But the first part of that was Musk, right?
No, the first part was Zuckerberg. I think I called him the most disappointing person, someone who is morphed into a troll, in a really toxic troll, in a way that is so disturbing to watch. He's really gotten radicalized in a way that is very typical of many people online, by the way. Or anybody who's subject to intense propaganda and thinks he's right all the time. You know, he thinks he's living in the Matrix and he's the hero of the story, but he's not. He's really just a troll and a jerk. And I think he has immense power. He has no pushback from people around him. Everybody's on his payroll. And he's got challenges, he's talked about them himself. He's got mental challenges. When you're that rich, nobody tells you you're wrong, and you get rid of everyone who tells you you're wrong. And that's what's happened here.
And just to be clear, you were just now talking about Musk, right?
Musk, yes, yes. With Mark, it's a different story. I think in my many interviews to him, he's not a radicalized person. I think he's actually probably, apparently, from what I understand, a very nice family guy. He has nice kids, everything else. I think what he's done is he's taken on responsibility for something he's completely inept at doing or doesn't feel like doing it. And that's a different thing. That's someone who has these massive responsibilities and has just decided not to take them or not to do anything about them, including allowing. We had an interview in, I think, 2018 or 19, where we argued about anti-Semitic bile that was flowing over Facebook in massive amounts. And he felt it was OK. I felt it was going to lead to bad things. And so his lack of ability to anticipate consequences made me feel he was inept to the task that was ahead of him.
Mm. So let me play another Zuckerberg clip that I think goes in a way to the point you just made. This is from just a few weeks ago in late January, when he and other tech CEOs testified before Congress about the links between the teenage mental health crisis and social media. This is from his opening statement, where, opposite of what we usually expect from corporate CEOs, he seemed to be asking the government, regulate us, please regulate us. Listen.
I hope we can have a substantive discussion today that drives improvements across the industry, including legislation that delivers what parents say they want: a clear system for age verification and control over what apps their kids are using. 3 out of 4 parents want App Store age verification, and 4 out of 5 want parental approval of whenever teens download apps. We support this. Parents should have the final say on what apps are appropriate for their children and shouldn't have to upload their ID every time. That's what app stores are for.
So, Kara, if you even understood what he was getting at there.
Yeah, he's saying that it's Apple's job to fix it, not him. I think that's what he's saying. I believe that's what he's saying. It's his job, too. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a lot of push to get to have kids not able to use any of these apps. There was one in Florida just now. He's just always trying to push away responsibility on someone else. That's what he's doing there, essentially.
What do you think about that Florida law? For people who don't know, they passed a law this week that would actually ban kids, I think it's under 16 or 16 and under, from many of the major social media platforms.
I think it's I can't believe I'm agreeing with Ron DeSantis, but here I am. I've always pushed for age gating. I think this stuff is addictive. We don't know the impact on kids. We do it with cigarettes. We do it with liquor. We do it with driving. you know, and so I don't know quite why something that's obviously has addictive qualities and is affecting the mental health of young people, we don't consider important to think about regulating a little bit. And so I do believe in age gating and to have parents, you know, parents can do it themselves, but it's way too much to put in the hands of just parents. And same thing with cigarettes. Kids are going to cheat. They're going to get the liquor or cigarettes or whatever it happens to be. But at least we, as a society, we say maybe not so much until you're an age where you can really accept and deal with this in a much more mature way.
You mentioned AOL before. Here's Ralph in Washington, D.C., who said he read your older book about AOL, America Online. Ralph, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking the call. And hello, Ms. Swisher. And yes, I did read your book. And when I read the book, I was employed at AOL at the time. I worked there for 20 years. And before AOL, I worked at Prodigy as a bulletin board manager, or what you would term as content moderation. If I remember correctly, in the book, you referenced the Frank discussion board at Prodigy and how I think that you termed that could have been the beginning of Prodigy's downfall. I was a supervisor of the team of board editors that did the Frank, you know, that monitored the Frank discussion board in the evening.
Sure.
And I can agree with you about that. I can give you actual, you were right. You weren't wrong.
Uh-huh.
What I wanted to know basically was what you thought about the fact that these companies like Facebook and whatnot have gotten to be just too big to do content moderation. I mean, you look at Facebook and they have billions and billions of members. We had trouble monitoring the situation at AOL when it was just like 6 million.
That's
so
right.
The thing about it is, so I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, you know, that was a really interesting case because I can't believe you were both places. I mean, Prodigy, the joke I made about Prodigy was everything IBM knew about retail and everything Sears knew about technology. But it was, you know, the idea was that these laws needed to be put in place to protect them because people were libeling other people, et cetera. And so that was correct at the time. And I agree, the flood of this should have been anticipated and figuring out how to put things in place, which it's almost impossible when you unleash a flood of people to say whatever they want. I don't know the solution, and I don't think I know what it is, but I do know you don't create a business that creates this scale problem and then throw your hands up at doing something about it. And then meanwhile, guess who's the richest people in the world? These people. I mean, maybe they're not such good businesses if you have to run them in a responsible way. Maybe that's what's happening here. And so we allow them. It's like we allow like pharmaceutical companies or chemical companies to spew all their toxic waste into the body politic. And we have to pay for it. We pay just like the opiate makers. Like there's so many comparisons in society where we do stop these companies from doing things. And I'm not talking about excessive regulation. I'm talking about any regulation whatsoever. There isn't any. And the regulation that exists from the time caller's talking about, which was to protect them. The Communications Decency Act had in it the Section 230. And it was to protect them from giving them broad immunity to be able to grow. And now they've got this broad immunity and they can't even be sued. So this is like the best racket. Can you imagine a racket like this? You can't be sued. You're the richest people in the world. You don't have to pay the true costs of your business, and society pays the price for you. I think, man, I'd like to get into that business.
Well, and Ralph, thank you for your call. Politically
speaking,
the Democrats seem to emphasize policing misinformation. The Republicans emphasize not centering free speech, maybe because their side is benefiting more from the misinformation. And really, nobody wants corporations in the interest of their profits to decide what political speech is allowed to appear on their supposedly neutral platform. But the social harms of disinformation are very real. So do you have an opinion on what the right balance is?
First, I want to push back on the idea of policing and censoring. First of all, it's called editing. Like, they need to edit. They need to protect. Like, you know, Rupert Murdoch got sued and lost because of Smartmatic, right? He got sued and he lost and he paid almost $1 billion. There are prices to doing your job badly.
But he's got a newsroom with
journalists
who he employs.
That's
right,
great, but this is
the caller, Ralph, was
just
making the point about, like, anybody can go on Facebook, Twitter, et cetera.
then don't have a business where this happens. This is the thing. I think we have to rethink what a media company is. These are media companies, whether you like it or not. TikTok's a media company. It has impact. Just because it lets anybody do anything, they're not a phone company. They're a media company. And they'd like to have you think it. And then Republicans throw around the word censorship quite a lot, especially for people who never shut up. And that's an interesting, that's another discussion. But it's not censorship to say, these are the laws of, this is what we do. We do it all the time across media. And we talk about the idea of editing, the idea of responsibility. And immediately people go into this free speech dementia that is really kind of odd. And even, you know, even Zuckerberg, he's like, First Amendment. I'm like, the First Amendment says government shall make no law, not these companies.
Right.
These companies can do whatever they want if they feel like it. And they're not here to protect our First Amendment rights. They're here to make money off our engagement. That's what they're here to do. And to pretend otherwise is laughable. And that what they do is they cloak themselves in the First Amendment. They cloak themselves in free speech and then proceed to be hypocritical. Elon Musk is a perfect example. Some free speech, except the people that I don't like. And then I throw them off. Like, give me a break. I'd rather you sit down and stop talking about free speech, because they don't really want to protect free speech. They want to protect themselves and their interests, which I get, but I wish they would stop lecturing us, the rest of us, about it. Again, so it's government shall make no law. Government shall make no law.
We got that great call from Ralph with sort of an internet origin story. I think we're getting another one from Evelyn in the Katona area. Evelyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for having this particular session. And I have skimmed the book, that I bought the book is amazing, and I'm happy to actually read every single word of it. I skimmed it. It's fantastic. But the reason I'm calling is that I used to work at Prodigy back in 1984. That particular company was CBS, Sears, and IBM. So one had the computers, one had the communication, and one had the shopping arrangements, agendas all lined up. And I remember sitting in many, many meetings regarding content moderation. And I would say one-third of our company, at one time or another, the employees were called in to read, to listen to edit. And the conversations, what's baffling, and the reason I'm calling, is that was back in 1984. So what has taken so long to resolve the issue of appropriate content for the audience? And it seemed as though when it was small, we were able to do it. And as the technology advanced with editing capabilities, I don't understand why emphasis and money wasn't put into that aspect of the product.
I get your point. Yeah. Because it's expensive. That's why. Because it's too much. You don't create a business and then say, oh, well, I can't do what my business did. I can't fix what my business, the negatives of my business. You know, it's interesting. I mentioned Prodigy again, but they were the early ones, obviously. And AOL supplanted them very quickly, actually. It was a work in progress. I don't blame them for failing or CompuServe or others. There's lots of sort of pioneers along the trail who haven't made it. Over time, but they always pointed in a direction that this was going to be where news was delivered, where there was a lot of media going on, where there was a lot of communications, commerce, everything else. In a lot of ways, Prodigy kind of had all the pieces of it. It just was early before people were really using these things. And I think the reason they don't do it is because it's expensive. And they look better when they're not moderating. Now, there's all kinds of interesting ways to moderate. Like on Reddit, they do decentralized moderation, or they have contextual advertising versus behavioral advertising. Behavioral advertising really does lean into a viral content, which leans into hate. There's all kinds of ways they can mitigate this stuff. It's just not profitable when they do that. And that's the whole lie here, is that they're such profitable. They're so rich. They're so smart. Well, they're not paying the costs of what it costs to actually do it. They're just living off the first of all, the internet was paid for by the American taxpayer, just FYI. But it was they're just not paying the costs of the impact their business really has, and they're taking all the good bits. And of course, you would do that if you were wanting to make a lot of money.
Andy in West Sayville, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hi, Andy.
Hi. So I worked for a company called Playnet back in the early 80s, and they were the, and we had the first, what became Internet Relay Chat. When we finally went live with the system, we had not been online for a week when all of us young college students in our 20s were called into a, you know, because it was a startup and it was with the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and we're all working part-time for this outfit, and we get called in, and the president of the company says, hey, look, I just had a complaint from one of our main investors, because we rolled out the original system to the, you know, 500 investors. Just because someone tells you that she is a nursing student at one of the local colleges does not, in fact, mean she is a nursing student at a college. And, in fact, she might be a major investor's 13-year-old daughter, and you guys are flirting with her online, and he's not happy.
Yeah.
Which is, to me, ultimately the root cause of all this is anonymity, right?
Yeah.
A 13-year-old kid can't go into a grocery store and buy beer because they're going to go, you're not 21, and it's obvious. But we can all be completely anonymous on Facebook. We can all be completely anonymous on any kind of chat space or Reddit or anywhere else. If you have to actually have to sign your name to things, I think people are, A, a lot more polite, B, are smart enough to know, well, even if I think this, I shouldn't say it out loud. So if we really want to solve this problem, we have to take away, at least in some part of this space, the thing that was really great about the internet, which was that anonymity. But
such an interesting
ultimately
question.
Yeah.
Destructive, big, you're saying,
it's one,
Kara?
It's one, it can be. In some cases, anonymity is important to protect people, right? In terms of, you know, a rape victim or people in countries where they have to be anonymous, because although everybody's trackable now, so I'm not sure if that's really a solution anymore. I really do agree with you. I think it's like, if you can be whoever you want, you can act however you feel like. That said, a lot of people just act like jerks now with their names on it. Hello, Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like they just, they actually relish being trolls. But you're right. Anybody could be anybody they want, and it creates a situation. Sometimes it's fun, and there's all kinds of, speaking of Playnet, there's lots of kinds of games where people do that. And that's kind of cool and interesting when people are, have other personalities and things like that. But it really does quickly take a dark turn if that's the case. It takes a very dark turn where the problem is the way this is designed, bad players can really take advantage of it. Even if there are good uses for it, bad player, and there's no safety around that. The same thing with videos. You know, when they showed me Facebook Live for the first time, my first thought was mass murderer is going to put a GoPro on their head and kill everybody and then broadcast it. What are you going to do about that? And they, of course, had not anticipated this problem. And they called me a bummer. And I was like, I'm sorry. It makes sense. I'm not a mass murderer, but this is exactly what mass murderer is looking for, attention and to become famous. And so this is perfect. And so, again, it's the anticipation of consequences, which seems sorely lacking in this group of people. And it's one, because it's not profitable to anticipate consequences. And two, it's this juvenilization of these creators, that they are somehow special and magical and shouldn't be touched because their genius will somehow be, you know, hurt if we question them in any way. And I don't know, that's not how adults act. And this is, by the way, it's an adult business, a money-making business. And that's what I focus in on is, and the first line of this book says that it was capitalism after all. Everything else is just nonsense as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, Kara, you know, we're at the end of our scheduled time, but I wonder, do you have until the top of the
happy
hour?
To. Sure,
great, because we're getting so many great calls and I have more questions too. So we're going to continue in a minute with Kara Swisher, tech journalist. Her new book is Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with tech journalist Kara Swisher, author now of Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. So how sarcastically or not do you mean love story in your subtitle?
Because I do love tech, because I think it can do amazing things for people. You know, the key quote in the book is one by Paul Virilio, who's a French philosopher, where he says, when you invent the ship, you invent the shipwreck. When you invent the plane, you invent plane crash. When you invent electricity, you invent electrocution. And the point is, every single technology comes with it, both positive things and negative things. And the problem that I've been saying over and over again on this book tour I've been having is that we have the ships, which have made people obscenely wealthy. We have all the shipwrecks they've caused that we pay for, but no lighthouses. Why not? And so if you put in lighthouses, if you have things where it's responsible and it's focused on the people who actually paid for the internet, it could be astonishing around drug discovery, around climate change tech, around all kinds of things that would be helpful. But what's happened is a lot of people have gotten really rich. There have been some good things about it, no question. I mean, you're not going to like, would you stack rank whether electricity is good or not, good and bad, right? But why can't we have protections in place that make it as good as it can be to mitigate the downside and put pluses on the plus side? I've always thought tech could bring us together, and instead it's been used by malevolent players to push us apart.
Meredith in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, thanks so much. I just want to thank Kara for being the adult in the room and for calling on these tech companies to be responsible and be accountable. And I'm wondering what her advice would be to, you know, hold these tech companies responsible and accountable when so much of our activism and advocacy these days are, you know, on their platforms.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Isn't that interesting? You know, I think that's the thing. We're so reliant on these companies and giving them unlimited power. Guess what we have? Elected officials that can do something about it. Just the other day when Mark Zuckerberg was appearing in front of Congress, where Senator Hawley asked him to apologize to these families whose kids have been hurt because online they were blaming for suicides and different things that had happened to them. And he asked him to turn around and apologize to them, which he should do, by the way, and he didn't, FYI. He just said, I'm sorry for what's happened to you, which is not an apology. That aside, I literally wanted to turn the camera around and say, you need to apologize to these families for never doing something about it. Instead, you're a cosplaying, attention sponge who can't
possibly do anything. You're talking about the senator.
Hawley, yes, all of them, him in particular, because he like goes, forcing someone to apologize when you should be sorry yourself, you've never passed a law. Give me a break. These regulators work for us. These people, these legislators work for us, and they've done no laws whatsoever. They've done it in Europe. I just did a big interview with Marguerite Vestager, who they passed the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act. We haven't updated our antitrust. We haven't put in a national privacy bill. We haven't had algorithmic transparency. We haven't done, the list is long of the bills they haven't passed. So at this point, and, you know, the government is trying, of course, with some of these antitrust cases, but they're woefully outmatched. They've taken away money from these organizations, and they've subjected themselves to lobbying on this stuff, and so I at this point our legislators should be the ones doing something about it, and we should demand that they do.
Hey, Kara, does Nicole Shanahan appear in your book? She comes out of Silicon Valley and is now Robert Kennedy Jr.'s running mate.
She doesn't.
Have you ever covered her?
No, because she doesn't have any companies of, no, it's, that's just, I'm sorry, she's not a technology person. She can say she is, but I'm more of a technology person than she is, or more qualified in that, to talk about that. No, she married Sergey Brin, and she has a lot of money, and that's, I'm sorry to say this, but that's why she was picked, because she has a lot of money from a marriage to the Google founder, so,
yeah.
Okay.
So
great.
Do you think the political media is mischaracterizing her when they call her a Silicon Valley figure?
She's there socially, I guess. Sure, she has a company. Sure, everyone and anyone can have a company in Silicon Valley. I've never covered anything she's ever made, and it's just she's not an entrepreneur of any status whatsoever. And to say so is laughable. I'm sorry, it's just not the case. She can say so, whatever.
Ron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Ouch, Nicole Shanahan. That was rough. I wanted to, Kara, to comment on another shipwreck that's the result of, especially with the emergence of AI, is the suck that it's making on energy and these huge data centers consuming so much energy, it's reversing any gains we're making in fighting climate change. And that's it.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is like the computing power, especially around AI and not just that crypto before that. And just in general, a lot of these companies are actually doing some really interesting things around trying to figure out alternative energy things, largely because of costs, which is a good reason to do it. It just seems like good. But, you know, Google had something with cooling and heating from ground energy down below the earth. They've done solar, they've done all kinds of things. And so I think it's important to push them to do these things, because this is where a lot of the energy is being used. If you really look where things, it's in places you don't realize. And so I think this is a perfect place for tech to innovate on. And they have, it's not entirely true they haven't. Google was at the forefront of some of these things, but all these companies do know that they need to depend less on fossil fuels. A lot of them are working on as nuclear energy, and I actually find it fascinating, some of these small nuclear devices. I know that sounds scary, but actually it's really promising, the safe use of nuclear power. And I know I'm touching a third rail, but it's true. There's a lot of misinformation about nuclear energy. And so a lot of them, Sam Altman is working on a company. There's some stuff around fusion, hydrogen. I've been talking to a lot of these companies, and there's all kinds of ways they're doing it. But I do think tech has been at the forefront of trying to do things there. So in this case, I believe they're a little more forward than other companies in that regard. But you're right, it is a giant energy suck.
How do you see AI overall as life-altering, era-altering, maybe even species-altering, as many people do?
Yeah, I think it just, you have to make a reductive, you know, that's the thing, it's so reductive. There is either going to, you have the techno-optimists where everything is up and to the right, and you know they're wrong because they were wrong the last time. And then you have the techno-decelerationists, essentially, who are like, it's going to kill us. It's, you know, I had one person call me that if I didn't stop Sam Altman, I guess physically, he was going to kill humanity. And that's the plot of The Terminator. I understand the scientists in The Terminator, which I enjoyed as a movie, but I think it's a complex subject. We need to have our regulators in place understanding the problems and come to global decision making on things like killer robots, drone armies. Like, we should be able to say maybe not so much on the killer robots, maybe not so much on creating, you know, dangerous drugs. And at the same time, say maybe we should promote drug discovery on cancer and things like that, and have the government be involved in it. I know government's a dirty word, but it isn't. It just isn't. You're welcome for the internet. The government did that. The government does a lot of good things. And it should be a partner with private companies, because private companies are more innovative by their nature, because they're pushed by profits, right? They're more innovative. They like the stuff that's going on. You know, here, let me give a compliment to Elon Musk, the stuff they're doing. And I'm going to give a compliment to Gwynne Shotwell, who actually runs SpaceX. Some of the innovations they are making are very important. That said, we shouldn't just depend on him and them, because we need a wide ranging number of companies. And the greatest strength of the U.S. is the bottom up innovation that we have to promote among our people. And across the world, it's so incredible what's happening, and we should be pushing that. And instead of letting large companies dominate everything, there's nothing good is going to be happening with large companies dominating. Just historically, that's the case.
On that duality you were just pointing out between, I can't remember the exact words you used, but tech utopians and tech, what was the opposite? We have 20 seconds left. Were you ever a tech utopian, as so many people were in the early days?
20 seconds. I was a Star Trek gal. I'm a Star Trek gal. I believe in Star Trek. I don't love Star Wars so much. It's a dark and dystopian vision of the future. I'd love, as Steve Jobs said to me in an interview, I'd like it to be Star Trek.
And there's a pro podcast host who knows how to do 20 seconds in 20 seconds.
Sorry, you want more?
No.
William Shatner rocks. What can I say?
That was a compliment. That was a compliment.
Yeah, I know.
The renowned tech journalist Kara Swisher, who you can hear on her podcast On with Kara Swisher and the podcast Pivot with her and Scott Galloway. And her new book is called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Thank you for being so generous with your time and thoughts for us.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy Easter to all of you who celebrate. Have a great weekend, everyone. Stay tuned for all of it.